Welcome to This Is The Way Phase 4. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo. This is a podcast about the stories Marvel Studios tells on Disney+. It all started with WandaVision back in January of 2021. Here in April 2022, we've reached Season 1 of Moon Knight. Episode 4 is now streaming, and that's what I'm discussing today. The first episode debuted on March 30th, 2022, Episode 2 on April 6th, Episode 3 on April 13th, and Episode 4 last Wednesday on April 20th. Now we are two-thirds through a six-episode season. The finale is on track for May 4th. If you're planning on listening further today, you must assume any content officially released by Marvel Studios as of this recording is fair game for discussion. I don't set out to spoil you, but the premise of this podcast is discussing what we're seeing. This is your last chance to avoid hearing about everything up to and including Moon Knight Season 1, Episode 4.
Final warning.
If you'd like to ask a question or point something out, please send emails. This is the way phase4@gmail.com is our address, or interact with us on Instagram or Twitter at @thewayphase4. You can also check out our webpage at facebook.com/thewayphase4. You can find additional links by going to our Linktree link site at linktree/thewayphase4. That's linktr.ee/thewayphase4. If you're looking for Star Wars content, try our Linktree for that podcast at /thisisthewaypod and follow links there.
Now tell me this. If I send an email, where would I put the stamp?
Technology.
All right, episode 4 is called The Tomb. The episode has a Disney Plus stated runtime of 53 minutes. But from just after the Disney Plus splash to the start of the end credits is only around 45 and a quarter minutes. For this series, the descriptions of each episode are different on the Episodes tab, when you compare it to the main show page, which is when you select and then start an episode and then go back to the main page. The thumbnail or short description reads, Mark and Steven must find balance as supernatural threats ahead look to stop them. The longer description that accompanies the episode, if you then head back to the show page, reads, Mark and Steven trek the Siwa Desert with Layla to find Amit's tomb, but the threats ahead look to protect the goddess's resting place.
Hello? Where are you?
The directors for episode 4 are Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, back again after helming Summon the Suit, episode 2. After this week, the last two episodes go back to Mohamed Diab. Writers are credited as Alex Meenahan, Peter Cameron, and Sabir Pirzada for this one. Cameron and Pirzada also worked on episode 3 and will get partial credit for the teleplay and the finale. Oscar Isaac still is Stephen Grant, Mark Spector, Moon Knight, and Mr. Knight, and possibly a third personality. Mae Kalamaui is Spector's wife Layla Al-Fawli. F. Murray Abraham provides the voice for Khonshu, while Kareem El-Hakim is the motion capture performer, but he wasn't seen this episode. Or heard.
I thought it'd talk.
Ethan Hawke is Arthur Harrow. Salim is Khalid Abdallah, but we only see him for a moment at the beginning. Towerette is here. She's the hippo goddess played by Antonia Salib, at least her voice. And there was only one prominent Arabic song in the episode. It belonged to the late Sabah, a song called Sat Sat. Yes, there are other actors who repeat their performances from earlier episodes, but if I don't recognize them or they haven't been in anything stateside, I'm just going to choose to leave them out until they build a Marvel, Disney+, Lucasfilm resume that we can recognize them from. Pressing play on episode 4, you get the Disney splash, then a previously on segment, but it's not Mohamed Diab directing, it's Moorhead and Benson. They opt also for a non-traditional Marvel Studios slate opening with music on top instead of the fanfare this time. The show begins with an upside-down image of Salim, Avatar of Osiris, walking towards us with Khonshu's Ushabti. Then the scene kind of, or the camera kind of rotates upright, and he makes his way into a special room inside the dimension of the Great Chamber of Giza. Remember, I'm supposing this is not actually physically inside the Great Pyramid, but like the portals suggested when they were summoned to the meeting, they open to either some kind of pocket dimension or maybe even to the celestial Heliopolis, like in the comics, the suggested abode of the gods. That hasn't been confirmed. It's just an idea. So this shot is disorienting. It writes itself as Khonshu's Ushabti comes into focus. So maybe also our ideas about this series so far are out of whack or upside down, and things will be coming into focus in this episode. The Ushabti is placed on a wall with other seemingly special Ushabtis. I had supposed, I think, last podcast episode that maybe the ones inside the Great Chamber area were some of the other gods. I think this for sure is a special place, maybe for some of the top tier gods that have been missing from the Ennead, or like Khonshu, were trapped but not buried like Amit. In episode 1, Steven suggested to Donna that some of the gods were missing. I think unbeknownst to that persona, this is the spot where some of those have gone. They've turned to stone. The existing Ennead have done this before, but I can't seem to figure out if there's a plan here, or if just the squeaky wheels get the grease.
Steven, wake up! Come on! Wake the hell up!
So the next scene puts us back in the desert. There's a passed out Steven, and Layla is trying to wake him up, but somehow very close by are Harrow's men, and they turn on a spotlight in their general vicinity. How did they not see them already if they turned the spotlight on immediately near the location of where they were? Was something going on here? Did the moon or the stars give their position away? Because the first light that hits Layla's face is clearly them turning on the spotlight. And then the light bounces to show that they're getting closer. But the first light that hits her, no question about it, they turn on the spotlight. How did they get so lucky with just that? Why wouldn't they just have had the light on scanning the horizon if they had pointed the light right at them? And they do know that they're there because Layla starts to panic and continues to try to wake Steven, dragging him to the edge of the dune crest they're on while she's being fired at. Because the truck has a gun on the back. It begins firing at them. Layla and Steven tumble down the dune. He's still unconscious. Now, it's dark out. Even with the gibbous moon, the men in the truck don't immediately find them when they get down near Steven and Layla's SUV. But they saw them from, like, two dunes over. We're just supposed to suspend our disbelief, I guess, because it's just a poorly conceived scene. In fact, Layla makes a run for it. One of the men thinks he sees someone running. So then they stalk her, but she climbs inside and hides in the truck. Where did the men think that? Why wouldn't they just light the truck up with bullets? I don't understand. They turn their attention to the seemingly lifeless body of Steven. Layla finds some flares, ignites one in a desperate attempt to save her troubled husband, and the way she appears on camera brought to mind for me Ripley or even Alan Grant in Jurassic Park when he had the flare with the Tyrannosaurus. So the men in the truck turn towards her. The gunman starts firing back at her again. Now he lights up the truck. Oh, okay. They circle the truck and find a flare on the ground on one side, and that distracts them long enough for Layla to make a perfect throw and land her flare on top of an exposed ammunition crate that I don't know how she saw in the truck. But it's the kind of thing you know doesn't happen like it appears on screen in real life, but you see it also happen in movies all the time. This move causes bullets to explode like fireworks. Now, a flare can get much hotter than is needed to set off ammunition. It can get very hot. But it certainly wouldn't cause a chain reaction like we see. It would likely set off the bullets it comes in contact with, but there's a big chance the explosions then extinguish the flare, and the firing off of bullets from just on road flares would not create the scene that it does.
What?
We're not supposed to spend too much time thinking about this, because Steven woke up at some point in the commotion. He and Layla now are going to set off for the Seawood Desert, which is where Layla's tablet had figured the digging would be based on Senfu's map and the stars in the sky. Now, I suppose she has some really great software, because she was able to figure that out in seconds, despite being more than 300 miles away from where the map was originally created. The location they're going to happens to be somewhere Oscar Isaac, the actor, has been before, and I'm talking about the filming location. So the filming location for the Amit dig site is in an area of Wadi Rum, Jordan, which scenes from Rise of Skywalker were filmed. Now, on the drive out there, Mark and Steven have a regular battle for control, and this time it's through the passenger side view mirror, not the one that was ripped off. And I did check, and they didn't mess up that bit of continuity, so good job. But they reach a point where they have to begin walking, and on one of the rock formations is an all-black goat. I think I figured out the association here, and I tweeted this out, so if you check our Twitter, you'll see some of the images, and you'll see my notes that I'm about to read for you. So, the Egyptian god Amun was the chief deity of the Egyptian Empire. He became associated with all four elements and the sun as Ra, so then called Amun-Ra. The god was even worshipped outside of Egypt, in Greece, as Zeus Amun. Zeus Amun has been depicted with the head of a goat or a ram, with the elongated horns that we see on the goat that's standing on that rock formation. Now, in one depiction, Zeus Amun was pictured with Wajet, the cobra god, which was for Ra's protection, and also Horus, the falcon or bird-headed god, who was said to represent Ra on Earth as Pharaoh. The name Amon, A-M-M-O-N, is taken from ammonite, which is what the Romans called the mineral that they found near the ancient temple of Jupiter Amun in ancient Libya. Now remember, Romans called Zeus Jupiter. So this was in ancient Libya, because it is in present-day Egypt in the Siwa Oasis, the temple of Jupiter Amun. The site of this temple to Jupiter Amun, or Zeus Amun, is in Agirmi, which is at the Siwa Oasis. So they were driving out into the Siwa Desert, as we heard in the description. Alexander the Great, after his visit to the Siwa Oasis in 331 BC, was referred to as the son of Zeus Amun, something a Greek oracle, Erythrian Sibyl, confirmed. The tomb to which our treasure hunt is taking us in this episode is to the voice of Amit, Alexander the Great. So the goat is representing Alexander the Great. Back with Layla and Steven, our treasure hunting duo, they come upon Harrow's camp. They're already inside, and Layla suggests they forge for supplies. The tomb entrance has been opened, and they're both going to go inside. Mark tries reasoning with Steven to give him control in some of the reflective surfaces that Steven comes upon, because Mark is the one with the mercenary skills, but Steven refuses again. For the same reason he did in the car, he thinks that the deal is done now that Khonshu is gone. Mark says, though, you're putting Layla's well-being in danger, and he puts that on Steven's head. Layla finds more flares, but the camera then pans to an embalming tool wet with blood behind the tent. The camp may not have just been abandoned. It may have been attacked. In fact, this is an ancient tool that did come from within the tomb, as we will see later. Layla fits Steven with some gear to make the descent through the hole into the buried temple. They have some conversations, and since this is the same body of the man she fell in love with, her senses connect her more with the more sensitive Steven. It's interesting, then, that she's about to kiss him, and Steven basically stops her and defends Mark. Steven tells Layla that Mark pushed her away because he was trying to protect her from Khonshu, who wanted her as her avatar. She doesn't appreciate that protection. Steven says he understands, and Layla says she just wanted honesty, but of course Mark still has a secret that Steven doesn't know. Steven kisses Layla. Then she belays down the rope line into the hole, and when she goes down, Mark summons the strength to take control and uppercuts Steven in his own face with his own hand. At the bottom now, two statues seem to guard the entrance. Layla draws two symbols in Arabic in the sand that represent her father, and Steven notices when he descends rather abruptly. He also finds great enjoyment in this quest. His memories involve a lot of study to keep himself from losing control and sleeping, something we saw a great deal of in episode 1. Now he can hardly contain his excitement at getting to live it.
I can't even... So if they just sprang to life right now and asked me a riddle for passage, I'd be thrilled.
It's interesting and maybe horror movie trope-ish how he points out coming to life, isn't it? You know, mummy movies have that sort of thing all the time. You know, you say something about, oh, maybe they'll come to life. And then things do spring to life after someone brings it up. So while walking further in the tomb, we get our first hint that something is now awake. I feel like that's a sound that I've heard before in a movie, or I don't know, it just sounded familiar to me, and we'll hear this sound more in a few moments. Layla and Steven come to a juncture of several paths. Somehow, without an aerial view or drawing a map, Steven senses that this temple is laid out like an underground Eye of Horus. Horus, remember, is one of the gods on the Ennead that we saw his avatar, too. The story of the Eye of Horus is related to the mythology of his eye, plucked out by his brother Set, another of the gods, but one that we did not see in the Ennead. Now, his eye was restored to him. In some stories, it was restored by Isis or Isis, some by Thoth or Thoth, and some stories, it was restored by Hathor. Then it became a symbol of good luck and health and regeneration. Here, this symbol is basically a map of the tomb.
I mean, like, the resources needed to build this one. Our final avatar was a pharaoh.
Bloody pharaoh!
The long path seems to be the one that makes the most sense for the treasure to be found at the end.
And this long line ending in a spiral is the tongue.
The avatar would be Ahmed's voice.
That's right.
How do you get there, and where are they in this map? There's no you are here now sticker, right? Well, Layla and Steven come to an embalming chamber somewhere in the maze, probably close to the juncture at the nose and the ear of the map that he drew.
Hekau priests, judging by their masks and ceremonial stance, they would have been entombed in here to protect the pharaoh.
Hexa Hekau.
Sorcerers of their time. They've been down here for centuries, and these must be some of the unlucky souls who crossed their path.
That's an impressive send-off.
Layla points out the practice of entombing people along with the pharaoh. Practically, I think this practice was to ensure people did not conspire to kill the pharaoh. So if you were going to overthrow the pharaoh thinking you'd have a better time under a different pharaoh, well, you're out of luck, because you as a worker in his house had many opportunities to kill him. So the way to prevent that is if he died, you died. That means you are very vested in keeping him alive as long as possible. Now, in this case, the protectors here are said to be priests of Heka, magical priests. But remember, as with the gods of Asgard, high science may have seemed to people of that day as magic. The ability to heal was like magic. So these priests were basically sorcerers of their day. And here it's interpreted literally. They're magically alive. Stephen points out the blood and guts trail leading from the altar, and it is wet with blood. Whether they think Harrow or undead priests are doing it, it doesn't matter. Stephen suggests, let's not follow the blood trail, let's find another way. So apparently the way to the throat of this maze is up some scaffolding. So it's almost like this passage that's up is like going through the nasal passages of a head leading several places. The sinus cavities, throat. Stephen climbs up and sees more embalming and regeneration ceremonies, several pigments. Unfortunately, some of Hera's men came across a guardian of the tomb in some of the tunnels.
Hide! Hide!
Earlier, Layla had noticed bullet casings on the ground, but what were they shooting at? It turns out Billy has been injured. You know, Billy the cop? A Hekka priest drags him into the room and places him on the altar, and Layla had to hide behind the altar. The priest, clicking away, its own tongue missing from his own embalming process, begins by cutting into Billy's left side. That's the customary place that they would start in the embalming process. They would make an incision on the left side. He just starts removing organs and starts placing them in the canopic jars that are on the floor. Layla tries scooting further out of sight while the priest works on Billy, but she upsets one of the canopic jars. She makes some noise, the priest clicks away, and Stephen leans too far forward on the scaffolding. The priest hears him above and gives chase. Layla then distracts him by throwing a jar, and they both run.
Run!
Stephen runs off into the tunnel that's above, and Layla runs into what seems like a dangerous route around a chasm. Maybe there was a bridge there, and then it was knocked away once the sarcophagus was carried in. While the priest is giving chase to Layla, she makes it along the wall to the other side, but the priest, attacks her in the middle by grabbing around a rock, and then he leaps onto her when she makes it onto the last platform. His radius and ulna bones are exposed from having his arm broken off, and he attempts to stab Layla with those exposed bones. She reaches for a flare and bashes him with it. And then it ignites, and she sticks it into his eye socket. And he's clearly in agony, and she tries rolling him off the ledge, but she seems to go over as well. We get a hero moment for Layla. She saves herself from falling, but Harrow is on the other side of the chasm.
Oh my days. First one in. Tomb fit for a pharaoh. Topmost two. Nefertiti. Oh, it's got to be one of the big uns.
So, you kissed her. What are you going to do, try and drown us now?
Mark interrupts Stephen's excitement in a reflection on the water that surrounds the sarcophagus. He seems to have come to the X marks the spot on the map, and he seems to have come to a realization. Stephen told the truth out of care for Layla. It did feel like he was pleasantly surprised. And of course that emotion seems to have overcome the anger from before when Stephen kissed Layla and then Mark, attacked himself by punching Stephen in the face with his own fist.
Macedonian? No. What? No way, that's not right. That can't be right. That's Macedonian. But the only pharaoh... but, I mean, he insisted on calling himself Egyptian. But... I think we're looking at the long-lost tomb
of Alexander the Great.
Stephen gets closer to the center of the room. There is a great sarcophagus on a raised platform, almost like a mini pyramid. And it's the sarcophagus of Alexander the Great. There is a shallow moat of precious, life-giving desert water that surrounds that platform. It's kind of interesting there that water, being so precious a commodity in the desert, would be just underground, you know, surrounding Alexander the Great. We go back to Layla. She gets to her feet and brushes off Hera's backhanded compliment at having overcome the priest. But she can't ignore when he says, "My little scarab." She comes back into that chamber. He brought up her father. How dare he, right? That intrigues her, though. How did he know this? He continues. Hera says what he knows comes from having read Stephen/Mark's scales.
I read his scales. The scales do not lie.
Back to Stephen now. He opens the sarcophagus and sees the intricately wrapped body of Alexander the Great. He tears at the wrapping, Stephen does. He gets at the face and then breaks the jaw open, and he's able to reach inside the throat of the dead pharaoh, who is the avatar of Ammit, at least in this universe. Stephen reasons that would be where the Ushabti would be hidden.
Mark remembers everything that happened that day. Everyone who died, but one man stands out.
Back to Hera, who has the floor with Layla as he sits across the chasm from her. He's describing what he says he saw when reading Mark's scales. Layla believes Hera is indeed describing her father, and it seems like he even gets the color of his scarf right. Hera says Mark feels guilt for her father's murder, and Layla takes that to mean that Mark killed him.
A man with a fuchsia scarf, scarab details, handmade, made by his daughter, perhaps?
I'm wondering, though, if the mention about the color of the scarf is an indication that maybe Layla's father was actually acting as the voice of Ammit, the avatar for Ammit, and that it was Hera that was the partner of Mark, perhaps? Maybe he doesn't remember that. So Hera, as the avatar of Moon Knight, kills Layla's father and then finds the truth, quote-unquote, and decides to give up his avatardom of Moon Knight in favor of this new power for Ammit. Maybe we'll see Layla's father in a flashback holding that cane. Where did he get it, you know? Maybe it came from Layla's father, and that killing him made him assume the true avatardom of Ammit. Then killing Mark, Mark becomes the avatar of Khonshu out of, I don't know, convenience? I don't know. It was just a thought that maybe there was more to Layla's father, because he called her his little scarab, so maybe he had this scarab, and maybe that was what the search was all about in the first place. Maybe Layla's father was actually searching for the tomb to unleash Ammit, and Khonshu intervened, killing her father in order to preserve that tomb's burial site. You see where I'm going with this? Anyway, Hera is revealing this perhaps to sway Layla to his side, and maybe also to entice her to slow Mark's progress. He also shouts at her to wake up? Or was this a shout to his henchmen or something else alive that we don't end up seeing?
I do hope you find closure.
Wake up!
Back at the sarcophagus, Stephen rips the Ushabti from Alexander's throat or lung cavity. Layla finds the way to the chamber. Stephen is excited.
We won!
And the Ushabti goes to us.
So this is an impromptu Oscar ceremony? Get it? Oscar Isaac? Okay. Layla isn't having any of it. She calls out for Mark. Mark does take over and attempts to apologize and explain that it wasn't him. Layla still hates him for being part of the group that killed her father. Mark tells that story about how his partner got a little greedy and wanted to execute everybody at the dig site. And Mark's guilt is eating at him. And Layla implies that their relationship was forged in that guilt, not love. A noise that, to me, sounded a little like the clicking of the priests alerts Mark.
They're here.
He wants to get Layla out of there. But we don't see the Ushabti anymore after this scene. So either Mark gave it to her, dropped it, put it in a bag, maybe he put it back into the sarcophagus. There's really no escape, but Mark offers to hold off the men. Layla seems to still be in the chamber, but Harrow's men filter in with him. Harrow wants Mark to give up. Mark attacks the approaching henchmen, but Harrow draws a pistol and shoots. No Amit chanting here. I wonder why he resorts to the pistol. Come to think of it, how did Harrow get the staff in the first place? Is he now the voice of Amit? How did he get the staff, and why wasn't he in such grave danger from the Heka priests? How did they know? Is it because of the staff? How did he go through this ceremony of becoming the voice of Amit if Amit has always been trapped in this Ushabti? Well, Mark is shot twice by Harrow, and he falls backward into the shallow reservoir of water behind the sarcophagus.
I can't save anyone who won't save themselves.
The camera changes from a shot down on Mark's face to underneath, and it's appearing like he's falling into a really deep well, but it's not the case. When the camera shows his body floating down into a black void, there are no bullet wounds on him anymore. I'm telling you, this is Mark entering the afterlife.
You're Dr. Stephen Grant.
Maybe so. We have got pluck. Now let's see what we can find on our friend here.
Mark is about to be judged going through the field of reeds. Let me explain. He's in a sanitarium now, watching a movie of an Indiana Jones-like archaeologist and a young boy that's accompanying him. That's strange, but so is the usual suspects-like imagery that we start to see around the room. These realizations are starting to set in. So many callbacks are in the room from earlier episodes. Crawley is there reading off bingo number and letter combinations that do not make sense. You know, B22, B goes from like 0 to 19 or something like that. Anyway, Bobby and Billy are also there, but we saw Billy was getting eviscerated. They're there as orderlies. Donna is a patient. You know, Donna from the gift shop. She's holding a scarab doll that she held in episode 1. She held a bunch of them in episode 1. And now she's just holding one in her hospital chair. There are bright yellows and reds and blues in stark contrast to the almost all-white setting. Someone's there drawing pictures of birds with Khonshu's likeness for the head. I think it's the forger. There's a clock with an hour and minute hand set up that looks like the one that was at Anton's home, where Khonshu was standing above it when he said, "Tick-tock, Mark Spector." Gus the fish is there. There is a cupcake cart, like the cupcake truck from episode 1. Layla was listed in the closed captioning as a nurse. She's there fixing postcards on a board that also has colorful pictures with repeating shapes of triangles and ovals and circles. Layla does, though, seem more like a patient than a nurse. She's munching on Turkish delight. She's got a manic personality. And she grabs Mark's bingo board. She says, "He won. We won." Then she alerts the bingo barker that she won. She steals the prize, even though it doesn't appear as if he actually did have a winning card. She promises that she'll share it with him this time. You know, she steals back antiquities in the real world, and now she's stealing a prize. What is that prize for winning bingo, I wonder? Mark sees his reflection, but Steven doesn't respond. Upset, he lunges forward, but he has been drugged, and his foot is tied to the wheelchair just as his foot had been tied to the bed in episodes 1 and 2. A Moon Knight action figure falls from his lap to the floor.
Mark, we don't live in a material world. We live in a psychic world. Right? We're only able to make indirect inferences about the nature of reality. Like take, for example, this pen, right? To me, this is a writing utensil, right? To my dog, it's a chew toy. Both are accurate.
Mark doesn't shift personas, but he does lose track of time. Now he's in an office. A doctor's office. The doctor's office, the head of the sanitarium. It's Harrow. He's the doctor in charge of this place, and everything seems to be conspiring to convince Mark that he's in a hospital. But he's actually on the barge ferrying souls of the dead. He is certainly there. Now, I'm not sure Crawley or Layla should be there in this case, or maybe some of the other people too, but it does add to the confusion of this place. However, this particular instance of the barge may just be for Mark. The office that Harrow has doesn't make sense for a hospital, but it does closely resemble the upstairs storage area in London that Harrow had at his headquarters there. The rest of the hospital is in a particular order meant to evoke the same kind of order as the storage facility from episode 2. The office, however, is irregular. It's decorated in a way no hospital doctor would, throwable sharp objects around. It's almost like someone, either the gods or Amit or Khonshu or Osiris, somebody was trying too hard with Mark. Now, if they wanted to confuse him, whoever is putting on this or whoever is in charge of the ferry through the Field of Reeds now, it seems like they may have tried to go a little lighter on the similarities. You know, maybe now in charge is Towerette. Maybe she's now in charge of the ferry. Maybe she's one of the few gods that are left that are in charge of something. Because if Amit is not judging souls, Osiris is not judging souls, Horus is not judging souls, then maybe it's Towerette. Mark knows something is off. In fact, it's the Harrow character that finally tips the balance in Mark's favor. He realizes he's trapped, Mark does, when Harrow uses the same sort of line that he did as when he was dying, when Mark was dying in the chamber. He says, like, I can't help you if you don't help yourself. It's a lot like, I can't help those who won't help themselves, or I can't save those who won't save themselves. Mark then struggles to escape this room, the office. His drugged state is wearing off, but it's still affecting him. Bobby and Billy arrive as orderlies to contain him. But he does escape the room, and Harrow does seem concerned for their safety. Now, you ask, how do I know that this is, in fact, the sail barge of the dead? The clincher for me is the swaying lanterns in the hallway when Mark reaches a set of doors. He looks down the hall and the lanterns sway. First of all, there's lanterns in this hallway, and these lanterns look identical to ones that would be on a boat like that, on an ancient boat. But if it's as if the great boat began to turn and then the whole hallway swayed, it's unmistakable. That just could not happen any other way. It's unmistakable. So Mark hides in a room from the orderlies, and it ends up being the one that contains the sarcophagus containing Steven.
Mark! Steven! Mark!
Here's another clincher. Steven and Mark are separate people in this image. The last thing both remember is Harrow shooting them. This inspires them to escape together. And then there's a shared belief now that this place is not real. They come across another sarcophagus. A door is open and there's a sarcophagus, and this one is mostly blood red. Perhaps this is the third unreleased and unknown persona. Or maybe it's another one of the gods that have been imprisoned. Maybe it's not Jake Lockley. They pass by it, and the being inside seems to knock strongly and does not escape with them. I think this is likely the Jake Lockley persona we have not met, but it could be someone else. Maybe it's even Amit. The two continue down the hall, but a large stomping is heard. The doors open, and it's a hippopotamus dressed in royal Egyptian regalia. This is Tawaret. Just as Steven recognized and pointed out to Donna in episode 1, the hippo doll, well, she's there now. They're shocked, and she says hi. I am completely convinced this is a purgatory of sorts for the dead, but that it is something that is magically put on for people who are associated with the gods, maybe as avatars or former avatars, because there's no way that the MCU is establishing that there is an afterlife for everyone. And Mark does not seem to be a believer in all of this, except for the fact that he accepted the role of Avatar and knows that these gods have a real power. Whether Mark has visited this place before when Khonshu found him, I don't know. But the swaying lanterns clinched it for me that this is a design, you know, the design of Hera's office. It would have been enough on its own to convince me that this was a place associated with the gods. Had Mark never left that common room, I think we'd assume the same thing based on the nonsense of the bingo, the bird drawing, the cupcakes cart, the stark colors against the white. He is not actually in a hospital. This could be just in his mind, but if it's in his mind, it's placed there because he was an avatar of Khonshu, or because the gods are intervening here. He does leave that room and the office, and when I think of it, it's starting to seem like he was going through the passageways of his mind, kind of like the show Severance had indicated with the weird hallways. I don't know if you watched the show Severance, but there's all these hallways and rooms, and it's like a maze. Well, he's, you know, navigating the maze of his mind and rescuing Steven. You know, he's rescuing himself. There's no way that he has an identical twin. So, you know, there's no way that there is an actual hospital that looks like this. So he's not in a real physical place in this hospital. We saw way too much from Layla's point of view in the show, Harrow's point of view in the show. You know, Mark and Steven both had points of view. There's no way that Mark was watching this on a videotape and then, you know, conflated events in his life to make it seem like that part, the part that we first see in the show, is the made-up part. I think this is the smarter way to go, honestly, because if at the end we were supposed to still wonder, is he in the real world or is he not, then the writers, I think, would have failed there. Now, we're supposed to be ahead of the game. I think we are here. I think we're supposed to know, like Mark and Steven, this place isn't right. There is a real world outside Steven or Mark's head. The fact that we're shown Steven first in the show and Mark first in the hospital is another clue for me. It is Mark in the chair because he is the real person, right? Steven is saved by Mark in the hospital. Mark is the real person who went through this ordeal in the real world, and this in his if it's in his mind, put there by the Egyptian quote-unquote gods, you know, let's put it this way, if it had been Steven waking up, that would have gone with the meeting with the HR at the museum, you know, then if he woke up, we would have been, oh, remember the meeting with the HR where they gave him the pamphlet? And then he was warning that he would turn himself in and be drugged by the National Health Service. But that's not what happens. Mark is in the wheelchair. He's drugged. He's restrained. He did get shot, but again, he's the body's prime personality, the one with the real mother and father. How do I know that? They have been cast, so oops, you let the cast out of the bag. Steven may wholly be a creation by Mark. You know, maybe that's part of his disorder. And Jake may be the dirty secret that Mark and Steven don't want to save. That, you know, they pass by and ignore him. So that could be part of his dissociative identity disorder. Maybe Mark lightened his soul by coming clean to Layla before his death. He did so as Steven, and he did so as Mark, right? So maybe he lightened his soul. Now, what's left are two episodes where we're likely going to get some backstory about the rift between man and gods, the one that we saw Steven reading about in episode one. There's also a rift in Mark's mind, and he's working that out right now. And then there's also a struggle amongst the Ennead. There's at least the one that left Ammit entombed in a Ushabti with the Macedonian pharaoh, Alexander the Great. Maybe it's a lot bigger, and maybe we'll see some of that background as well.
This whole structure, it's a symbol.
That's the Eye of Horus.
Yeah. Look at that.
What?
Right? The royal symbol, protection in the afterlife.
I would love to hear what you think. I have a lot of theory videos to watch on YouTube, but I will be back again with another discussion podcast sometime after episode 5 becomes available on April 27th. Rebecca Kirsch and Matthew Orton seem to be the ones that will get writing credit. Neither of them seem to have worked for Disney, Marvel, or Lucasfilm yet. And again, you know, when someone has a prior history, like Michael Castelline, you know, we like to mention that. But these people don't seem to have writing credits. They seem to have producing credits, strangely enough. Mohamed Diab is, though, back directing, and he'll stay in that chair for the last two episodes. That's all for today, so please check out our links on Linktree at linktr.ee/thewayphase4 and send your email to thisisthewayphase4@gmail.com. Again, if Star Wars is more of your interests, I also produce and host This Is The Way podcast. We're getting ready for Obi-Wan Kenobi, and at the end of May, that show will debut, and we have news update podcasts that come out in mid-month. Links for that show can also be found on Linktree at linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. Thank you so much for listening to This Is The Way Phase 4's Season 1, Episode 4 discussion of Moon Knight. I'm Steve Lascalzo. Until next time, friends.